You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Blogging Heads watchers and listeners. I'm Gregory Gause. I'm the head of the International Affairs Department at the Bush School of Government and Public Service at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas. And it's a pleasure to be back on Blogging Heads and joining my old Blogging Heads friend, Shadi Hamid.
Hi, Greg. Good to see you. It's been a long time since we've had these Blogging Heads debates, but good to see you. I'm Shadi Hamid. I am a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution Center for Middle East Policy. I'm also a contributing editor at The Atlantic. And we can start talking about the very crazy situation that we've seen in the Middle East, and particularly with Saudi Arabia and also Turkey, over the past, 18, 19 days now. But Greg, do you want to kind of, let's start with your New York Times op-ed. You wrote a really interesting piece, I think it was about 9 or 10 days ago.
And yeah, it was a week ago Friday.
Yeah, I love the title. It was, is MBS, the young Saudi crown prince, more of a disruptor than Trump, or too disruptive?
Too disruptive, even for Trump.
Yeah, Trump has a tolerance for this sort of thing, but maybe this is going too far. And obviously the context here is what then was the disappearance, but now is the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, a Washington Post columnist, U.S. resident, and a critic of the young crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. Do you want to tell us kind of like what was the overall case that you were
sure.
making? Maybe we can kind of just go from there.
Sure. I think there's two main trends of argument on this about the Saudi role and the repercussions for U.S.-Saudi relations. The first is obviously the moral one. The Saudis are clearly responsible for the death of a journalist who was absolutely no threat to the regime, but just a critic of the regime. And there are, of course, moral implications for that. The second track of criticism, and that's the one that I took, is more about what does this say about the new crown prince in his foreign policy, his role in the region. He has taken a number of steps which have basically backfired on Saudi Arabia. We can start with the war in Yemen, which has dragged on now for 3.5 years almost exactly 3.5 years. And without a resolution that the Saudis and the Emiratis, when they went in, one assumed, and they assumed, that they could clean up the Houthis pretty quickly. But now it's turned into a quagmire and a humanitarian disaster, which has implications not only for the U.S.-Saudi relationship, but for the region. And there is even more erratic behavior. The boycott of Qatar, which has gone nowhere except to divide important American allies. Qatar, of course, is a place where the U.S. has its largest base in the region, the big air base at Al Udeid. The bizarre incident of in effect, kidnapping the Lebanese prime minister back in November and forcing him from Riyadh to resign his position in an attempt to create a political crisis in Lebanon that MBS thought would damage Hezbollah. Didn't happen at all, and they had to climb down. The overreaction to the tweet from the Canadian foreign minister, kind of trying to cut off relations with Canada, and now this. I think it bespeaks a Saudi foreign policy that's kind of the opposite of what we've come to expect in regional politics from Saudi Arabia, which is caution and a premium on stability. And it does call into question the judgment of the crown prince. Can he see the second and third order consequences of his actions? And that was the tack that I took.
Yeah. So, the question then is, well, first of all, is it possible to constrain MBS? I mean, is that one possible scenario where the U.S. puts pressure on Saudi officials and the Saudi royal family, and somehow enough people get the message that, yes, he stays as crown prince for now, but he reins it in and he understands that he's gone too far? I think it's a nice idea. I think it's unlikely in practice. People don't change overnight. He is who he is. He has a particular personality. He is 33. Not that there's anything wrong with being relatively young. I'm not that much older than MBS. But I think that there is a real question about judgment, and people can't go from bad judgment to good judgment very quickly. So that it raises a lot of questions for the U.S.-Saudi relationship, and there doesn't seem to be an easy resolution. And I'm curious, so you've kind of laid out all these problematic aspects of Saudi foreign policy. What do you think the U.S. can or should do? Because I think I haven't gone back to our old debates from 2011 or 2012, but I think that we did disagree a little bit on how much the U.S. should do, how much right. can do, how should we use our leverage with bad allies. And, Saudi Arabia is one bad ally. We have several bad allies. So what would you say?
Yeah, I think we actually disagreed a lot back in 2011 on these questions, and we'll probably do some disagreeing today, which is why they've paired us up. But I take the point completely that the U.S. ability to kind of micromanage the domestic politics of Saudi Arabia is counterproductive because it's likely to fail and could boomerang on us. In fact, I think that one of the criticisms one can level at the Trump administration among the 14,000 criticisms I could level at the Trump administration, one of them would be that they tried to play into Saudi domestic politics in an obvious way, and now it's coming back to haunt them. I mean, MBS was their guy, and the Trump White House made that absolutely clear. In fact, tried to take credit for his elevation to being crown prince. And I think that was at the time, I thought that was really a dumb thing to do. But I do think that there are some things that we can do to try to put up, kind of bumpers, try to put up some guideposts to keep the young crown prince in his lane. And I think that has to do with having a serious conversation between a respected American interlocutor. We don't even have an ambassador in Riyadh right now, and we haven't since the beginning of the Trump administration. But I think we've got to send somebody who has a lot of weight in Saudi Arabia. And I think James Baker would be the ideal guy. And he's kind of offered himself up to do that with this op-ed in the New York Times today. But I think he has to go and talk to the king. He and the king are contemporaries. The king has known him since the Gulf War, if not before, back in 1990, 91. And you're young, Shadi, but I'm ancient. Right. And so I actually remember the Gulf War of 1990-91. And I think that it would be incredibly reassuring to see a senior member of the family appointed to the foreign ministry as just a sign that MBS can't unilaterally make foreign policy. And I think that can be done without too much upset in the domestic situation. I think if we pushed a la Lindsey Graham to get MBS out, and we said, we're not dealing with Saudi as long as this guy's in power. And that's kind of what Lindsey Graham has said. I think that could lead to a serious problem. I mean, MBS controls all of the security apparatus in Saudi Arabia now. He's defense minister. He's been the guy who's appointed the commander of the National Guard and the minister of the interior. I would worry that if there was a heavy-handed U.S. effort to dish him out, things might get dicey in Riyadh. But I do think that we have enough influence with the king to talk to him about the way there has to be some limitations on this, because MBS is foreign behavior. And we're not even talking about domestic political behavior, and we can talk about that later. But the foreign policy behavior is run against a lot of American goals in the region, even the Trump administration goals in the region.
Yeah, so you said – so there's been a couple of points on this. I mean, first you said that Trump made a really big bet on MBS, and he came to see MBS and Saudi Arabia more generally as a linchpin – of a different and somewhat new Middle East strategy, at least compared to Obama. I mean, what's striking to me is that, and this is a point I've been making in over the last few days, it just seems very, after everything Trump has done for MBS and the Saudis and giving them a lot of leeway to pretty much run amok in the region, but also to crack down on dissidents and to not say much about it. For MBS to return to favor, so to speak, in such a manner and embarrass Trump on the world stage, it really smacks of disrespect. And I can't get into MBS's mind, and perhaps he doesn't see it that way. But in effect, it comes across, I think, if from an American standpoint, hey, like, we're America, this is how you treat us. And this is how you treat Trump, one of your biggest ally and someone who's really tried to have a close relationship with you. And that's where I think Lindsey Graham has made a strong point in this regard, where he said, I feel, quote unquote, used and abused by the Saudis. And I think that Marco Rubio on Fox, either yesterday or earlier this morning, said something like, this has been very disrespectful to us. So I think, and that is something that you would think would appeal to Trump, that, hey, they're not respecting you, Donald Trump. And I think that's important in a transactional relationship. And clearly, Donald Trump sees a lot of foreign policy as maybe not entirely transactional, but at least somewhat transactional. And maybe some of that is a bit self-styled. But I think that that's what's so troubling about the relationship here, that there seems to be an imbalance.
Right. And I think. Yeah, I mean, I think that Donald Trump doesn't just see foreign policy as transactional. I think he sees life as transactional.
Right.
But I think that this is an occasion where the Saudi elite, and not just MBS, have to be reminded that they're not a great power. I think MBS sees the way Putin reacts, trying to poison his enemies abroad, the way the Chinese act, and he says, well, Saudi Arabia is a powerful country. Why can't I do the same thing? And they're not a major power. Their power is limited. And his uncles, who ruled the kingdom for the decades before, I think that they had an acute knowledge of the limits of Saudi power, right? They had lived through Gamal Abdel Nasser and the Arab nationalist phase. They had lived through the Iranian revolution and the Iran-Iraq war. They had lived through the Gulf War, where they had to call on outside support like the United States. I think that they had a sense of the limitations of their power. I don't think MBS has that sense. And if it hasn't been brought home to him by this episode, I think it's really important for the U.S. in a discreet way to send, I'm repeating myself now, but to send somebody who has clout in Saudi and respect, not necessarily of MBS, but of the family as a whole, and say, look, we've got to talk about what your limits are.
So it's funny that when you said by the time of this episode, for a second I thought you meant our Blogging Heads episode, and I thought you were overestimating our influence with the Crown Prince.
I think our influence with the Crown Prince, the instrument has yet to be invented that could measure how little influence we would have.
Right. But, so this is where we might differ. So that we do have tremendous leverage. And as you sort of alluded to, we in the U.S.-Saudi relationship, we are the senior partner. The Saudis are that fundamental difference. And in other words, they need us a lot more than we need them. Perhaps some could quibble with that, but I do think it's true. I mean, we are a superpower, and we have also provided a security umbrella for Saudi Arabia and other Gulf nations for decades now. And so it's not even just about the arms sales. It's about broader security provisions and essentially being the main backer of the Saudi regime. And for them to threaten to buy arms from other countries, for example, Russia and China, again, it shows a certain level of disrespect that they can just do away with a very important relationship upon which they've depended. And also, who wants to move from U.S. military provision to Chinese or Russian? I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. There's a prestige factor here. It would look really, really bad. And what I say is, hey, if that's really how you feel, Let's go for it. Let's see how that works for you. And you can feel free to come back to us if that doesn't work out, or if it turned out to be precisely what it likely is, a bluff.
Right.
But this is But in terms of what we can actually do in the coming weeks and months, I do think we have to demonstrate to the Saudis that we are very serious. And I think they can tell that there is considerable outrage, especially from Congress. They've seen what Lindsey Graham has said and so on. But I think they're probably betting that some of this will stay at the level of rhetoric, and that when push comes to shove, Lindsey Graham is not actually going to, quote unquote, sanction the hell out of Saudi Arabia. So I think at some point there has to be some demonstration of seriousness that goes beyond the symbolic. So what I think, I'm not someone who believes in a complete severing of ties between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. I mean, some people have called for that. And I just don't think that's realistic. And I think it's, you know, because I work at a think tank, perhaps I have to keep some mind to what is actually plausible in the real world. And we are not.
Shadi, does that mean professors don't have to keep in mind things that are plausible in the real world?
but you're actually, I think you're more realist. You're more realist-oriented.
Yeah.
Than I am.
I'm certainly a capital R realist in the IR framework. Yeah,
I'm a bit more of a moralist, so that's why I'm somewhat torn about how far I want us to go. But a middle compromise, if you will, is to say we will consider suspending arms sales, or we will move in that direction unless the Saudis make a good faith effort to comply with certain requests. And we can kind of put that on the table and say, well, don't count on the arms sales. We want to see some improvement in certain areas. And for me, those would be accepting an independent investigation. And that could mean a UN-appointed panel. And then to ask them to respect the outcome of that international independent investigation. And we can talk about what that would mean in practice, and obviously that would lead to some difficult situations if the Crown Prince was implicated, but either indirectly or directly, of course, but also the destructive Yemen war and getting serious about a political solution there and not making this the never-ending war that the Saudis want to just do, you know, for God knows how long. And there could be other things too, but I think those would be the two major ones.
So I'm suspicious of the UN investigation process. I mean, we saw that in the Hariri murder in Lebanon, went on forever, didn't lead to anything, right? I mean, the UN tribunal implicated Hezbollah in the murder of Saad al-Hariri, if I remember the results of that correctly, and absolutely nothing happened. To me, I would lean more on the foreign policy stuff. Yemen war, I think that a serious effort has to be made. The problem for the Trump administration is that it has, you know, put enormous emphasis in its Middle East policy on confronting Iran. And if you're going to get a settlement of any kind in Yemen, the only outside power that has any kind of influence on the Houthis is Iran. Now, I think that we have to work through that. I think the Yemen business should be on the top of the agenda for us, a serious political effort that the Saudis would sign on to in a serious way. And that means that they would have to abandon what is their baseline negotiating position on Yemen, which is that the Houthis have to disarm. Nobody in Yemen disarms. It's the most heavily armed country in the world. It makes us in Texas look like gun control freaks if you walk through any town in Yemen. And I think that we have to work the Qatar angle. I think that this is a clown show, this boycott of Qatar. While it's not certainly on the level of the Yemen situation or the Syrian civil war, God help us, it's an impediment to the stability of the region. And I know this is this kind of mantra of stability is something I've always been suspicious about. But I think when you have an ally like Saudi Arabia that's been that disruptive, it is important to kind of come back to first principles. What do we want out of this region, right? And what we want is not violence and chaos and failed states. What we want is the free flow of energy, because that's what the world cares about from the Persian Gulf. Right. And we want some modicum of stability, so you can plan and anticipate and maybe try to help rebuild these states that have fallen apart, not just in the wake of the Arab Spring, but the Iraqi state was falling apart from the 90s and the sanctions, and then our war that just was a horrible mistake and tipped Iraq into civil war. So I mean that's where I would, you know, put the issues. But I agree 100%. There needs to be a set of issues where we go to the Saudis and say, all right, look, you guys have gone off the rails here. We got to put you back on the rails as part of our overall relationship, which is valuable for you, valuable for us, but more valuable for you than it is for us. And yeah.
Well, we may actually – I don't generally see stability as the be-all, end-all of U.S. foreign policy or U.S. Middle East policy. And I've actually been a critic of the stability first paradigm because I think it gets us – it doesn't actually – I don't think empirically it's been very successful over the decades. The Middle East has been quite unstable for quite – you know, for some time now, and we can debate when that instability
– we can debate that, but yeah.
Right. But we can maybe get back to that in a second. But I do want to come back to – some of the moral questions around responsibility for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, because at some level we can talk about regional politics and these bigger questions, but at the end of the day, we saw a terrible, reckless, brazen act of murder. That's absolutely disgusting. That if we see if even half of the details that have been leaked out about how the murder may have actually happened are true, it shows a level of brutality and inhumanity that is quite shocking, I think, even for those of us who have worked on the Middle East for quite some time, right? And the idea that we would give the Saudis a pass by not having some kind of independent investigation, and I'm open to other options about how that could actually be done. And if MBS himself was directly involved in orchestrating the murder itself, and again, some of the leaks would suggest that he was, you know, again, we don't know for sure, but if that turns out to be the case, then are we comfortable with someone like that leading Saudi Arabia for perhaps the next, I don't know, 50 years?
Yeah. So, I mean, the level of comfort is an important point here, but I just wonder about the practicality of these things. I mean, it would be nice if Putin, you know, weren't trying to murder Russians who have defected to the West. It would be nice if Xi Jinping wasn't rounding up Muslims in Western China. It would be nice if a lot of world leaders acted better. I don't know if the effect of a full-on American push to, in effect, indict Mohammed bin Salman wouldn't lead to, and here I come back to the term, instability in Saudi Arabia. Would there be a family fight? Would he take to the streets? I mean, he does basically control the security services there. And that's where I get a little more cautious. I see these efforts at international justice as being noble in their intent, but falling far short of getting positive results when they're actually implemented.
Isn't it different here? So you mentioned China and Russia, but the difference there is that they are adversaries, or perhaps even the enemies, if you want to use that word, at least Russia. This is an ally and a close ally traditionally. So doesn't that change the calculus a little bit? That obviously China and Russia can do things and we have little leverage over them. They're not even allies, really. Saudi Arabia is. So how does that factor in?
Well, I think it factors in the way we were talking about before. You go to them with a list of things that this is what you've got to do to get things back on the rails if you don't want, you know, a second round of this, which could be more damaging. But I think we might get there faster than we think, actually, because of the Magnitsky Act in Congress. I mean, and it does seem to me that the Congress is all heated up on this. And I'm no expert on the Magnitsky Act, but my understanding is that you don't even need. I mean, this can be done without a without having to override a presidential veto. I mean, in effect, Congress has started the process requiring an American investigation, and that investigation could lead to Congress designating MBS as someone who, you know, can't get a visa to the U.S. and can't get access to dollar-denominated financial systems. That's pretty rough stuff, yeah. It seems to me. That in some ways is rougher than an international tribunal that has, you know, absolutely no enforcement capabilities.
And you would support that? You see that? So where do you
I don't – see, no, I don't think I would support it right now. I would rather get progress on the foreign policy issues to bring the Saudis back on the rails, as I would say, than to immediately go to the personalization of this with MBS. Now, if the Saudis don't react right, or if MBS does, as one Saudi commentator threatened, and kind of use oil production at a time when, you know, we know that we're going to try to enforce sanctions, secondary and tertiary sanctions on countries that buy Iranian oil. Those sanctions are going to come on in what, 2 weeks? If the Saudis use the disruption in the market there to lower production and push prices even higher as kind of a quote unquote punishment, then I think that you know, we have to get that then targeting MBS himself through congressional action, I think, is the only rational response. But if the Saudis, right, signal through their actions in the oil markets that they're willing to come back on the rails, as it were, then we have this larger talk with them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so let's go to this broader issue that we've sort of touched on a little bit, and I think this is where there might be more daylight between us. So I'm curious about exploring it a little bit, because I think that this episode, but not just this episode, but the series of events that have led to this point, and we can include stuff like the kidnapping of the Lebanese prime minister, which got so little coverage at the time, at least in the U.S. And it's such a crazy story that I remember I had to read back to make sure it really happened. Did I just imagine that they did that to Saad Hariri? Right. But I do think that this is one indictment in a series of indictments of our starting assumptions of how we do business in the Middle East, that there is something fundamentally wrong that keeps on leading us to this point where we have to indulge very bad allies who undermine our interests, but also our values. And for me, those two are probably somewhat intertwined. Mm-hmm. But I would say that this is not just a Trump administration thing too. We have to, so if we kind of go beyond the personalization of this and say, oh, look what Trump has done to embolden autocrats. This would have never happened under Obama.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, exactly. And I got in a little bit of Twitter back and forth with some folks yesterday, where I think some former Obama officials were really trying to, you know, make this point. And I'm like, come on. I mean,
yeah, really?
I mean, the Yemen war obviously started during the Obama era. And we can even go back and talk about Saudi backing for the military coup in Egypt.
Right.
Which isn't necessarily like an MBS thing, but it's a Saudi thing.
It's that was pre MBS.
Yeah, right. So there's a lot of those things happened under previous administrations. But then it raises the question, should we be relying on authoritarian allies to the extent that we have? Is there a bigger, a more fundamental reorientation that we have to start thinking about to move away from this so we don't keep on falling into the same traps and the same dependency? And also it's a question of stability. Again, I don't like seeing stability as – I see stability perhaps – more as a means than as an end unto itself, perhaps. But I think the problem with so-called stable authoritarian regimes is that they seem stable until they're not, and then it's too late.
Yeah, you and Robert Kagan.
Yeah, so and we saw that with the Arab Spring, that Hosni Mubarak seemed stable, but then obviously almost overnight, we saw the situation changing tremendously. So perhaps then the argument, and this is an argument I have made, is that authoritarian regimes are inherently unstable in the long run. Because at some point they will cease to be stable because they lack something so fundamental, which is the consent of the governed. Right. They also lack a mechanism for peaceful succession. Democracies are better at succession because if most people accept the legitimacy of the democratic process, then there is a way to change leadership and rotate leaders peacefully. Authoritarian regimes will always be vulnerable in that particular respect.
So let me fire back.
Okay.
I think that you can make a good case that authoritarian regimes, and I'll limit this to the Middle East because that's the only part of the world I know anything about. You can make the argument that authoritarian regimes are unstable in the long run. Unfortunately, democratic regimes are unstable in the short run. and I think that it's a hard sell for foreign policymakers to say, let's risk a lot of instability in the short run and really push these people to change their government, even though they might fight against it. And it might take, you know, if people rise up against their governments, we might have to intervene to help them, i.e. Libya. And we can't assure that there's going to be a good result and there's going to be a lot of crockery broken. But, you know, this apparently stable authoritarian is a long term bad bet. And I think, you know, I just, you know, quote Keynes on this. In the long term, we're all dead. And foreign policy has to be conducted on a day-to-day and week-to-week basis. And particularly in the Middle East, if you're not going to deal with authoritarians, who are you going to deal with? Now, I think you can make and I would include Benjamin Netanyahu in that definition. Everybody's an authoritarian in one way or another in the Middle East, including our closest allies, the Israelis, who are moving, while still a democracy in many ways within their original borders, are moving in a direction that is troublesome to people who support liberal values. So it seems to me that there is a choice. I think there's a serious choice. And to me, the serious debate is the only thing we need from this part of the world, and this is a caricature, but it gets at the argument. The only thing we need from this part of the world is oil. Right, it really doesn't produce anything else that anybody else wants. You know, the Turks have an active export trade with Europe, and good on them. The Israelis are a really dynamic economy now. They trade with Europe, you know, high tech, good on them. But for most of the rest of the region, the only thing people care about is energy, and they can't drink the oil or snort the gas, and so it's going to have to come out. And that means that every once in a while we're going to have to deal with, you know, some upheaval. But that's what we have the Strategic Petroleum Reserve and the International Energy Agency for. That, I think, is a serious policy argument. You know, I'm not buying it. I still think that we have enough reason to be there. But it seems to me that the argument that we should be reorienting the policy more toward the encouragement of democratic change is not going to get as much traction as an argument that basically says we got to leave these people to their own devices.
Okay, so let me take a couple things there. I mean, first is this idea of, do U.S. politicians or policymakers anywhere in the West want to risk instability in the short term? But, I mean, there has already been instability in the short term. So even this reliance on authoritarian regimes, like, let's say hypothetically, if that had led to a quieting of the region and the absence of chaos and quote-unquote stability, then maybe people would have a strong argument there. But we have seen a lot of stability. So this idea that we can't risk instability in the short term, I'm not sure I buy it, because we already have had instability in the short term. So I'm now looking for alternatives to that instability that we see in Yemen, now to some extent with Saudi Arabia, also obviously in Syria.
Libya.
Libya, I mean, the region is very unstable, and I would say it's unstable as a result of a policy that has generally been rather indulgent of authoritarian allies. So that's one thing I would say.
Well, I got to push back on that, okay. Because I think that you're right in some cases, but in Iraq, the instability is not because we were indulgent of an authoritarian ally. It's that we wanted to go in and change the government, at least ostensibly, and we can argue about how sincere this was, and I think it differs from person to person in the Bush administration, but ostensibly, not just to get rid of the fictional weapons of mass destruction, but also to bring a democratic government to Iraq. And in Libya, I don't think that we can say that Colonel Gaddafi was an ally of ours. And again, that was an intervention originally justified as a humanitarian responsibility to protect intervention that then quickly morphed into a regime change intervention with the hope that there would be democracy in Libya. So I think that you're half right in places like Egypt and maybe even Yemen, but there's another half of the story where we helped to encourage that instability in the false hope that we would get better governance.
Let me take issue with mentioning Iraq in this. You're right, certainly about the Iraq war, but there was a reversion to the norm of indulging an increasingly authoritarian figure, Nouri al-Maliki, in the late
2000s. And then we got him out. The Iranians really are the ones who got him out.
Indulging of him for several years under the Obama administration did contribute, I would argue, to a crisis and did contribute to the rise of ISIS and the general kind of falling apart of things. But putting that, we don't have to go too much into that. The other point I wanted to make is, isn't there an in-between position where instead of saying that democracy has to be the goal for, say, Saudi Arabia, I'm realistic enough to say that Saudi Arabia is not going to become a democracy anytime soon. However,
And if it were, we wouldn't like the outcome. We can set that aside. That's a hypothetical.
Okay. But what about using leverage to pressure authoritarian allies to become less authoritarian? So we're not trying to overthrow them. I'm also realistic enough to say that, hey, we're not going to be able to pressure Sisi out of power. Mm-hmm. He is going to be, until enough people in Egypt decide otherwise, he's probably going to be the person we have to deal with. That said, we can use pressure if we're serious about it, and if we're really willing to stand by our position and to use leverage to the full extent and to call the bluffs of allies when they challenge us on this and say, oh, you're not serious about using your leverage, that we can actually encourage some opening of political space. We can encourage pockets of dissent. We can stand by those who are fighting for freedom of expression, journalists, and making sure that there is some independent journalism that is allowed, that some opposition parties have at least a little bit of space. Those are things that I think we can encourage, and that does fall short of the full-on, let's try to make something into a democracy overnight. And there, I think, that is not necessarily risking too much instability. And it's also standing, and I think we probably disagree on the values part, and that I think it's important just because I want to be able to sleep at night, and maybe because I'm a young, naive person that this is important to me. But, I think that America stands for something, and that's just a different world. That's just a different set of starting assumptions.
And I'm old and cynical, and I have no trouble sleeping at night after a couple glasses of wine. But I think that there's a more effective bit of leverage than you paint on the opening up of political freedoms, right? This Davos in the Desert Investment Forum is opening up in Riyadh, and this was going to be one of MBS's, showcases to try to convince people to invest in the country. It seems to me that the real leverage that we have on somebody like MBS is when Google and other major American firms Microsoft, you know, you can go through the list of the places that MBS visited, you know, when he did his tour here in the States. When they don't show up and they say, we can't be part of your great vision 2030 to transform your economy with foreign investment and a knowledge economy and all, because you are too erratic. We can't feel comfortable in investment in your country when you lock up 300 or more of your of the elites, of the economic and political elites of your country, and never charge anybody publicly with anything. It does seem to me that in this particular case, I don't know, in Egypt, I think it would be different. But in this particular case in Saudi Arabia, our most immediate and best form of leverage might not be governmental. It might be a talk with MBS about how, look, you are not going to get even domestic investment if you are a chaos agent, both at home and abroad. And I would start with that, because I think that that's the kind of thing that is that an authoritarian leader like MBS and might be better able to handle. Right. Yeah. Whereas if you go right into, you got to open up the press and you got to let these people out of jail, that would be step two for me.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Let me ask you about something else you said about oil. That's the main thing that the Middle East offers, and that's why it matters and all of that. But I think one shift that I've noticed over the past couple of weeks, as all of us have been debating U.S.-Saudi relations, is that oil has come up relatively little.
Oh, I don't know.
at least in kind of following the debates and the op-ed pages, okay, and on different channels and all that. And even Trump hasn't really brought up oil. He brings up arms sales. He doesn't talk about energy, really. I don't think Lindsey Graham has brought up oil. Maybe he's I don't know. But we're also less dependent. The U.S. is less dependent on Saudi oil than at any other time in recent decades. I mean, this is not the 1970s again.
Right.
So even when the Saudis are threatening to cause chaos in the oil markets, that would affect our allies and Europe and Japan and who knows who else. But, you know, with the with changes in our own domestic oil production, the shale revolution, things like that, and you know more about this than I do, so I'm curious. Maybe that is a fundamental shift where we care less about the things we used to care about a lot with the Saudis.
Right, and my pushback, and I'm not buying that, because I don't think that the relationship with Saudi Arabia was ever about American reliance on Saudi oil, right? We started this relationship with the Saudis when the United States didn't import a drop of oil. And most of the oil that we import from Saudi Arabia these days is because Saudi Arabia owns this huge refinery down on the Texas coast, Motiva. And they put their oil in because they're looking to get downstream profits off it. I think that the reason Saudi Arabia is important is because the world oil market is in fact a world market. Right. There are differences between the West Texas price and the Brent price because of the American energy revolution. Right. Oil, West Texas intermediate, is about $10 less than Brent these days. But if the Saudis were to, decide to play this game, which I think would be a disaster for them in the long term, it would ruin their argument that they're a reliable supplier to the world market. But if they did it because MBS was just mad, and could pull this off, my neighbors here in Texas who are fracking their farms and their ranches and are the source of much of this American energy revolution, they're not going to give me a better price just because they're my neighbor. As world oil prices go up, our oil prices are going to go up. And I think that's still the key reason why we care about the Persian Gulf.
But would Saudis ever take those kinds of extreme measures, which, as you point out, would be self-destructive? It would really damage Saudi Arabia in perhaps a permanent way. It would also, I think, show that they are really a chaos agent and they're willing to become incredibly chaos-producing.
Right. If you ask me what the chances are, I would say they're extremely low. But if 3 weeks ago, if you had asked me the chances that the Saudi Arabians would put at risk their regional relationship with an important, if prickly, partner in Turkey, and run the risk of a blow up in their relationship with the United States to murder a fairly mild critic who was absolutely no threat to the regime. I would have said, of course they won't do that. That would be ridiculous. So I mean, this whole theme that under the current dispensation in Saudi Arabia, they're doing things that are in fact counterproductive to them in the long term can't be ignored.
Yeah, that's fair. And I know we're running out of time, so yeah. I just want to bring up one last thing.
Sure.
Because the Middle East produces something else besides oil. It produces instability and chaos,
yeah.
Which does ultimately find a way to come back to haunt us as Americans. It finds a way to come back to haunt Europe. If we think about refugee flows and spillover effects from the Syrian civil war, right. I would argue that has been a major driver, not just of instability in the Middle East, but also of instability, particularly in Europe. And we can, you know, the rise of right-wing populists who have drawn strength from a refugee spillover and so on. But even the fact that would Trump have been able to propose a Muslim ban when he was running for president if there wasn't a bigger conversation around Syrian refugees and things of that nature.
Right.
So, I mean, there are these indirect effects. And, you know, I know that some of us, including my colleague Tom Wright, who wrote a good piece about this in The Atlantic, where about moving away from this phrase, the liberal international order, we wonks sometimes like to say that the U.S. protects and ensures the liberal international order. And with ordinary Americans, that just sounds totally remote and detached. But, you know, there is this, the U.S. does, there is something to this liberal international order of
agreed. I agree completely with that. Yeah, that there's something to the international liberal order. Go ahead. Sorry, didn't want to.
Exactly. So to the extent that the Middle East is producing instability, which then undermines international order, then that is something that really does matter to us. And there's a lot of terrorism. Right. We haven't even mentioned the fact that terrorism matters, and terrorism does tend to be exported from the Middle East.
Points taken on all that thing. On the terrorism thing, I think that we have vastly exaggerated the threat of terrorism, from 9/11 on. I think that this could have been dealt with much more as an intelligence and police matter. This notion that we had to go in and reformulate the Middle East and break all the China and you know, completely redraw, you know, drain the swamp, which was the post 9/11 mantra in the city in which you live, I think was just so wrongheaded.
Huh? No one used drain the swamp. But wasn't that more like a Trump came up with drain the swamp?
No. Go back to 9/11. Read Tom Friedman. Tom Friedman.
Drain the swamp?
Yeah. As I recall, Friedman was talking about that. We got to get this stuff out of the basement and bring it up into the light. And there was a lot of drain the swamp talk.
Yeah, right.
This predates Mr. Trump. Mr. Trump was still running The Apprentice at that time, which I think is the highest level of his success. But I think that the instability issue in Europe and the outflow of refugees, not just from Syria, of course, but from North Africa and from sub-Saharan Africa through North Africa, that's really important. But I have to say that after the fiasco of Iraq, I thought that was the Europeans had more on them to do. And I think that we should have helped them, but we couldn't take the lead on an intervention in another civil war. And so I take the point, but I think that it would be a mistake for us to say that America was primarily responsible for trying to deal with the Syrian situation. The Europeans have the resources and all, and it should have been more coordinated, but I don't think it would have been politically feasible for any American president. And we have to remember, right, that who's won the last three elections? The candidate who was less hawkish on the Middle East has won the last three elections. Obama-McCain, Obama-Romney, and Trump-Clinton.
Okay, but
the dovish candidate on the Middle East won all three of those elections. America is tired of these wars in the Middle East, right?
I would question a little bit the idea that Trump was a dovish candidate on the Middle East. I mean, this is a guy who was
Iraq war is stupid. Syria, we're not going to get involved in. We're going to pull our troops out. I mean, and then he would talk smack about the Islamic State. But yeah, Trump's having a consistent policy from Trump would be an exaggeration. You're right.
Yeah, right. I was going to make on Syria, as I think we might have had a little bit of this debate, and you probably remember that I did support military intervention yeah. against the Assad regime. So I think that's probably won't agree on that in retrospect. But I do think that what about confronting Iran? Because that's come up a little bit. How much does that affect our interest? How important is that? You mentioned that in the beginning, that the Saudis aren't even good on the one thing they're supposed to be good at. Because we're trying to rely on them to confront Iran, and that's one of the major goals of the Trump administration. But as you point out in your New York Times op-ed, they have failed in every place they've tried to confront Iran.
Look, I agree. And I think that's a real problem with the policy. I personally like the JCPOA. I thought that was an interesting long-term bet on trying to get the Iranians to act less like a revolution and more like a state. I didn't have any illusions that was going to happen in a year or two. But I thought that the basics of it were right to push the Iranians back from a weaponization threshold. And I thought that in the longer term, it was a bet worth making because the previous policies of isolation hadn't worked. Now, I think that you have to be able to do that while also working, say, in Iraq. And here's one of the few places where under MBS, I think there's been positive change. You have to do that. You have to engage with the Iranians on that question. At the same time, you're trying to reduce the kind of leverage that they have in Iraq by getting the Saudis to engage with other partners, with other players in Iraq. And I think that if you can't shake their hand and stab them in the back at the same time, you're not cut out for diplomacy. And we should have had a much more subtle, and I think the Obama administration was moving that way. And I think the Trump administration has lost that subtlety. So yeah, I mean, to me, the biggest problem in the Middle East is failed states. We can deal with states that have addresses, and we're going to see that with Saudi, I think. You know, a state with an address and a phone number, America's pretty good at dealing with. And that includes Iran. That's our friends, our enemies, and our frenemies like Turkey, right? What we can't deal with is the collapse of state authority like Syria, like Libya, like Yemen. We're really bad at that. And when we created it in Iraq, we were really bad at dealing with it. So to me, you deal with the people who have addresses and phone numbers, even if you've got problems with them, and that's a general approach. But you are right that we're testing the patience of our watchers and listeners. So I'm going to give you the last word, and then we're going to sign off.
Oh, I wasn't going to give you the last word, but I'll say this: it sounds to me like one thing we do agree on, as we kind of run through the list, is that the Middle East does. We can disagree about how much it matters relative to other threats, but there are a number of things that come up. But let's say that even you and I, Greg, we decide that we're overestimating the importance of the Middle East. The problem is that others act as if the Middle East matters a lot. So U.S. politicians will probably always end up paying a lot of attention to the Middle East. And even those like Obama and Trump who have tried to disengage from the Middle East end up still being very involved.
Yeah, it's like Michael Corleone in Godfather 2, you know. Every time I try to get out, they drag me back in.
Yeah, exactly. So perhaps then we have to adapt to that reality and say, we might wish it were otherwise, but the Middle East is always going to matter to us as Americans. Anyway, so that's my last word.
Right.
Thanks to our listeners for joining us. Greg, you want to close us out?
Sure. Shadi, it was great to talk to you again. Great to be back on Blogging Heads. And thanks to everyone for watching and listening.
Great. I hope to see you soon, Greg, and hope to talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Before you go, a quick message from the suits at Blogging Heads TV. Blogging Heads will always be free for you to watch and listen to, and we don't even go the NPR route of guilting you into donating during Pledge Week. But we do have a small request. If you enjoy Blogging Heads programming, rate and review us on iTunes. The iTunes algorithm weighs positive reviews heavily, so taking a few minutes to rate and review us will help more people find out about our shows. Also, of course, we encourage you to subscribe to our Twitter and Facebook feeds. Thank you.